The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Vladimirovich Putin.
Vladimir Putin remains shrouded in mystery. His private life kept under wraps, while his official biography is the only glimpse into his past.
When he was named Prime Minister in 1999, he asked a few journalists to write his official biography. And ever since, any research into Putin's path to power has been completely forbidden.
Putin was born in Leningrad in 1952. After his parents lost two of their sons, he was the miracle child.
It was a simple upbringing, a communist upbringing. His father was a party member, while his grandfather used to be Stalin's chef. So young Vladimir grew up in an environment that fostered faith in the Soviet model.
Putin joined the KGB after law school. In 1985, he was sent to East Germany to work inside the University of Dresden. From there, he saw the Berlin Wall come crumbling down and with it, the Soviet Union itself. A national humiliation Putin would later describe as a catastrophe.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I've shared many times he sees that as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And his ambition, I think, is to restore, you know, Russia to the prominence the USSR once had. But who is he? I find that audio striking. That was an investigation piece from France 24 into the life of Vladimir Putin. His life is surrounded by mystery. Write my official biography and looking into my past, well, that's completely forbidden. Why is his history shrouded in such mystery? Now, I think it's important to know who you're dealing with, especially when he heads up a superpower, when he's been able to ascend to power and hold on to it for as long as he has. So, you know, it's not just the U.S. All eyes right now, the world, is looking at what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. And everyone wants to know what Russian President Vladimir Putin's next move is going to be. And he's saying, again, I'll reiterate what he says. These are drills. We're not going to invade. This is just, these are exercises. U.S. intelligence says, no, it's 100%. It's 100% probable he's going in. You know, most of the people in our country, I'm sure, have heard of Vladimir Putin, but you might not know a whole lot about him. So, yeah, I think he's the president of Russia, right? Maybe you knew that he was a KGB agent when he was younger. His history is an interesting one, and we're going to be speaking with Angela Sten about it today. I'd like to give you a little bit of his background, kind of learn about who is Vladimir Putin. Are there myths that surround him? Is he truly Christian? Is he not? Is he a murderer? I mean, what do we know? How much is he worth? He was born back in 1952 at the height of the Cold War, as you heard, and he grew up and was formed by the ideology of the Soviet Empire. Studied German in high school, joined the KGB in 1970. He went on to then Leningrad to spy on foreigners, and you know, he was then sent to East Germany, and he was there when the Berlin Wall fell. And he saved some documents while destroying others. And then he went back to Leningrad, and there was a coup attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev, and he resigned from the KGB. At that point in 1990, he went into politics and started to work for the mayor of the former, former Leningrad, now renamed St. Petersburg. But from there, despite some scandals, you know, he worked his way up, eventually came to the head of the FSB, and that's the agency that replaced the KGB, and Boris Yeltsin, he appointed him to a premiership, and after Yeltsin resigned, he was elected as president, and from there on in, he's kept himself in power one way or the other. It's kind of a broad brush. There's so much detail to him. 8th degree black belt, a whole litany of other things. How true are the things we know about Vladimir Putin, and who is he? I'm joined right now by the senior advisor to the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at the Brookings Institute. It's good to have with me Angela Sten. Angela, good afternoon. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. Good to be on your show.
Now, I understand you have met Vladimir Putin many times. What were those encounters like? What kind of man is he? Is he charismatic? How do you read him?
So in 2004, the Kremlin started, I think, a very shrewd public relations series of meetings where annually they bring foreign experts on Russia to Russia. And we traveled to different parts of Russia. We had discussions with Russian colleagues, and then we always met President Putin. And I would say for the first 10, 12 years, we also had these small dinners with him, wow. just the foreigners, not the Russians, after the conference had ended. And so you got a pretty good look at what it was like to sit at a table with him. And he's someone who I would say wears a mask most of the time. Mm-hmm. He was, after all, trained as a KGB agent. I've seen him flare up with some anger occasionally, but usually has that under control. He's very much in command of his facts. And the other thing is, you know, there are not too many world leaders who will sit around with foreign experts on their country for 2 or 3 hours. So people are pretty impressed by that. He also has a very, you know, unique sense of history. I'll just tell you a couple of anecdotes. We were at one dinner with him, and a British journalist asked him, "Why do you still have Lenin in the mausoleum in Moscow?" And Putin said to him, "What country are you from?" And he said, "Well, I'm from Great Britain." And so Putin said to him, "Well, why do you have a statue of Oliver Cromwell, near the parliament?" And he said, "Lenin, Cromwell, the same thing, revolutionaries, regicide, etc." And so the poor British journalist did say, "Well, we haven't actually embalmed him." And then the other interesting anecdote or true story from Putin is we were sitting around at one of these dinners and talking about missile defense. And of course, the Russians don't like the American missile defense system. And so Putin said, "Why can't we work together like the Soviet Union and America did in the 1940s when they jointly, you know, developed atomic weapons?" So we Americans were kind of looking at each other. Is he saying what we think he's saying? And then he explicitly mentioned, Julius Rosenberg and what we would call American spies. Yeah. But he, you know, said that we work together. So he has. And, you know, we've seen since then. So but he is someone who I've heard him at these meetings say a lot of what we even saw him say in his speech today, that the breakup of the Soviet Union was a catastrophe, that the different Soviet republics shouldn't have been allowed to leave the Soviet Union. He said a lot of critical things about Ukraine along the way. And interestingly enough, and this we'll probably come on to that later, in the latest iteration of this conference, which I only attended virtually because of the pandemic, he made a speech kind of condemning American wokeness and political correctness, and talking about the traditional family values. He has said that, and he said this at Valley, that the Western Christianity is satanic and has lost its way, and only Russia and the Russian Orthodox Church sort of the true Christianity. Well, so he's really putting himself forward now as the leader of a kind of conservative international movement.
I would agree with him on some of those points. I mean, the stuff that the United States is putting forward, the craziness with the wokeness that we have here. But I'm just curious as to whether or not Vladimir Putin means those things. Is he conservative? Is he an Orthodox Christian? Or is that show? Is it one of the masks that he wears? I mean, what do we know about where he really stands on both Christianity, faith, and homosexuality, a lot of these other issues that he seems to have a much more stringent perspective on than the U.S. does?
Sure. Well, as you yourself pointed out in your introduction, there's a lot we don't know about him, and that's deliberate. He does, after all, come from the KGB. We do know, just to come back to a moment, for him, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism, if you like, was a personal tragedy. Here he was, this mid-level KGB agent in his mid-30s in the East German city of Dresden. The mob comes and demands to see their files when the wall came down. And he describes in this autobiographical essay in 2000, staying up all night and trying to burn all these files. And then the furnace exploded because, it couldn't accommodate all of that. Right. So we do know that at least when he was in the KGB, he was a good communist. And at least ostensibly, like all Communist Party members, they renounced religion, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he comes back to late Gorbachev's Soviet Union. He's missed the Gorbachev period. And as you said, he eventually resigned from the party, and then he joined the administration of the mayor of St. Petersburg. And he suddenly became transformed from a communist official to someone promoting a very wild sort of capitalism. He was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg in charge of foreign economic contacts. Now, you know, in terms of his faith, we do know that in 2001, when he met President George W. Bush for the first time in Slovenia, he was wearing a cross. Mm-hmm. And he then explained to President Bush that this cross had been in the house of his grandmother that had burnt down. And the one thing that had survived was the cross. So we don't really know whether that's a true story or not, but that's certainly what he told President Bush, and they apparently did have a discussion about religion. And now we know that he, you know, he has a personal confessor, Father Tichon, who did come to one of these Valdai meetings, you know, these annual meetings, and was on a panel there. We see him attending church, at least on the major Christian holidays. And of course, he espouses values. And in fact, in the Russian Constitution, they've now have written, for instance, that marriage is between a man and a woman. So does he really believe this? Nobody knows. But the Russian Orthodox Church has now been, I would say, restored to the role that it was under the Tsars. It's the official church. Interestingly enough, it's the only Christian religion that receives official recognition in Russia. There are four official religions: Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and Judaism. So no other form of Christianity, and obviously there have been many conflicts between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. No other Christian denomination has official recognition. That doesn't mean that there aren't Christians in Russia that follow other forms of Christianity, but and so the church is, has a great, a very political role. They very much support Putin. They go and bless the troops before they go out and they're sent into battle. But what his personal feelings are, I think we'll never know. But he certainly is very supportive of the church and involves the church in affairs of state.
I'm curious about his rise to power, too, because I'd like to know who the man is. Is he a murderer? I mean, one of the things that I had had read about his rise is, you know, when he was prime minister in 1999, he was alleged to have had been behind a string of apartment bombings that killed about 300 residents and were officially blamed, I think, on Chechen separatists at the time. And, you know, Putin denied the allegations you know, the bombings provided, though, a rationale for the military campaign in Chechnya. And that coincided, of course, with Putin's first run, you know, for the presidency. I'm curious. A lot of his opponents, several of his critics and opponents have died in very brutal ways. They've been poisoned. They've been shot to death. Accidents have happened. What do we know? I mean, about Vladimir Putin and his background, is he a murderer? Has he killed multiple people? What can you reveal?
So, I mean, he was trained as a case officer, so that we know, well, again, what we know about what he did in Dresden was that he was, you know, he'd recruited people. And as he said, in an understatement in this autobiographical essay, that, you know, he worked with papers and people. Mm-hmm. Now, when he became prime minister, it is true that there was a series of apartment bombings, and these were used as an excuse to go into Chechnya for the second time. There had been one war in Chechnya beforehand, which had ended inconclusively, and they used that as a way to decisively defeat the Chechens who were trying to gain independence. There were fundamentalists there. There were terrorists there, too. But anyway, they defeated them. It's never been conclusively proven that these fires, these bombings were carried out by the FSB, by the Russian security services. But of course, there's a lot of doubt about who actually set those bombs. So that's really how he began his reign as prime minister and then president. And then, as you say, a number of his prominent critics have died. They have, you know, some of them haven't died, but they've been poisoned, like Alexei Navalny, who is now in prison in Russia, but was poisoned, and that's been also traced to the FSB. There were some opponents of his who were poisoned in London. So certainly there are a number of mysterious deaths. It's obviously very hard to pin anything on him specifically, but we do know that this Russia is now run by people from the intelligence services in a way it wasn't even in the Soviet period. I mean, the Communist Party had the intelligence services under control, but now it is people from the intelligence services who run the country, and they, of course, you know, political assassinations are part of their playbook.
So is he now president for life then? We know that he's changed the Constitution. I mean, how long will Vladimir Putin be in power? And he's what? How old is he now? Is he in his 70s? No. How old is he?
He turned 70 this year.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he can now, he had the Constitution changed in 2020, so he could stay in power until 2036. But if he wants to stay in power beyond that, presumably he can. So, he could be, you know, there are a lot of Russians who believe that he will be in power until the day he passes away. There are other people who think, well, maybe he'll engineer some transition. The problem is, and this is a problem of all authoritarian leaders, they fear that if they leave power, they might lose their assets, they might lose their personal liberty. And so that's the incentive for them and the people around him who support him to stay in power.
Yeah, I was reading about his wealth. I mean, he is fabulously wealthy. One data point I saw was he's worth probably, and his net worth is anywhere between $40 billion and $200 billion. What do you know about his wealth? And you know, if I had that type of money, and I understand power is intoxicating, it always be something nice as I approach my 70s just to enjoy my wealth and enjoy life and not have the pressures of national governance and let alone international affairs. But how did he make that type of money as a government worker? And what's he worth?
Well, I mean, who knows what he's worth, right? But some people say he's the richest man in the world. You've cited the range of figures. I wouldn't be able to tell you. I think nobody knows. How did he make his money? Well, when he came back to St. Petersburg from Dresden and the beginning of this kind of wild capitalism I was describing, he and a number of his friends formed a kind of collective. They benefited from, basically the assets of the Soviet state were up for grabs. They got many of those, and they have continued to make a lot of money on rents from oil and gas revenues, essentially, and other revenues. So that's how they've made their money. But the problem is, as the Panama Papers showed a few years ago, you're not going to find bank accounts with his name on it. All this money is hidden and is in other people's names. So it's a lot of this is speculation. But essentially, they have made money off the treasures of the Russian land itself. While the Russian people, of course, have been denied that, and the Russian people had lived much better when he came to power because oil prices were high. But when oil prices are low and with sanctions and things like that, their standard of living isn't very high.
Right. Let's do this. My guest today is Angela Sten. If you want to join us ever for a few minutes, I'd love to have you join the conversation. The number is 888-914-9149. If you're just tuning in, we are looking at Russian President Vladimir Putin. Who is he? What do we know about him? In some respects, he really is a man of mystery. And I think a lot of people are now raising those questions as the world could be on the verge of war. Denise is listening in Chicago. Angela, let me bring her into the conversation. Hi, Denise. Go right ahead.
Hi. Alexei Navalny is definitely not dead. He's in prison, but there was attempted poisoning of him. He's been advocating to the Russian people to oppose Putin. And for that reason, he has had many attempts on his life. Also, you got to remember, in 2014, Putin took over Crimea. He just waltzed in. And he thinks he can do the same thing with Ukraine. He wants to rebuild his Russian empire. And he doesn't like NATO. And he is not afraid of Biden. He was afraid of Trump. But he's not intimidated by Biden, and Afghanistan is a perfect example of a failure of leadership. Right. And he's certainly not intimidated by NATO and Macron.
Denise, thank you for calling. I want to pick up on your point there, because I think it's a really important one in light of what's unfolding today. And Angela, your perspective on this. I mean, does he look at the Biden administration as being weak? I don't know if he would have tried this under Trump. You know, he certainly doesn't want Ukraine ever becoming a member of NATO. And NATO is fracturing in some respects. You know, the pressure that he's now putting on it, we see how weak it really is. I love your analysis of what Vladimir Putin is trying to achieve and ultimately how he sees both the U.S. and NATO.
Well, first of all, I would not agree that he was afraid of Donald Trump. I think the Russians were happy when Mr. Trump was president because he promised a better relationship with Russia. Mm-hmm. And then they got disappointed in him because he couldn't deliver. And of course, the reason he couldn't deliver was because of all the questions surrounding what had happened in 2016 and the kinds of comments he made about what a great guy Putin was. But they certainly weren't afraid of him. So they, you know, they look at the Biden administration, yeah, and they look at the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. They see how polarized this country was, as it was under President Trump. So that they've been looking at this, you know, for a number of years now. And so they, I mean, the reason why Putin has struck now, if you like, is because he sees a weak and divided U.S. He sees a Europe that's also divided and struggling. Although I would say, you know, what he's done mm-hmm. in the last few weeks or the past couple of months is he's really revived NATO. NATO is really, it's got a new purpose. It's now deployed more troops than mainly American troops, but there could be NATO troops to the frontier, Eastern European members of NATO. But he is indeed trying to restore the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. not necessarily to have control over all of those former Soviet states, but certainly to influence them. And in the case of Ukraine, really, they do want to control the government because they don't like the fact that Ukraine is moving west or is trying to move west.
Right.
And he does think that this is his moment to strike. And I think he may have been surprised by the vigor of the Western response.
Yeah, I do too.
It is true. You know, we've been responding to the Russian agenda, but still, we've responded. Yeah.
You know, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, she went over, tried to, you know, present the reset button. That didn't go so well. But I've had other experts on the air, and a lot of people are saying, you know, we'd be better served if Russia was an ally rather than an adversary. I don't know how Russia views that, whether there's any compatibility there, but why do we remain enemies? And what would it take to somehow... you know, become allies?
Well, of course, we'd be better served if we had it were allies. I mean, you go back to the fall of 2001. That was really the high point of the relationship after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because after the terrorist attacks, the Russians, you know, Putin offered help to the United States in the first phase of the war mm-hmm. in Afghanistan. They provided us with information. And we both talked about, well, the Russians talked about, this is almost like the World War II alliance. The problem is that the Russian expectation from this, what they were going to get in return, was really mismatched with the American expectation. And what Putin wanted was to have the United States acknowledge that Russia had a right to a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. And instead of that, you know, he got, as he would complain, more NATO expansion. So yeah. that early period in the early 2000s would have been the time when we could have forged a closer ties. And then after that, Putin increasingly came to see the United States and the West as his enemy.
Yeah, you know, I know you're an expert on Vladimir Putin. You've been with him before in the past. And in some respects, if you look at his concern, I mean, if Ukraine became a member of NATO, I mean, we'd have, you know, missiles 500 miles, you know, outside of Moscow. You know, it's like having, you know, Cuba 90 miles off our coast having, you know, Russian weapons. There is a certain legitimacy to his concern there. But how do we resolve that? I mean, how do you find the middle ground, if nothing at all?
Well, the Russians know, as we know, that the question of NATO membership for Ukraine, you know, it's not off the table, but it's not on the table either. A promise was made in 2008, which probably shouldn't have been made, that said Ukraine will join NATO, but there was no specific timetable and nothing's happened since then. So that really isn't a real issue. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Russians keep raising it. And you know, I think even if the Ukrainians tomorrow said, okay, we're not going to apply to join NATO, I don't think that that would really change what Putin's doing now, because I think he's gone so far down this road, you know, that will hopefully prevent an actual major war in Ukraine with, you know, thousands of Ukrainians and Russians dying. But he said,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but just final thoughts from you, because I've got to take a short pause here. Do you think he'll go in and invade Ukraine? Is it too late? The U.S. is saying we have 100%, you know, it's 100% probable. What do you think?
Well, I think they've already announced today that they've recognized the two separatist entities as independent. They've said they're going to send peacekeeping troops there. I just read that. They still have 160,000 troops arrayed around three parts of Ukraine. So I think the likelihood of an invasion is probably by now 70%, but I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, I hope you are too. Well, look, I'll tell you what, I'd love to have you back to talk more. We've only scratched the surface of it. I find Vladimir Putin fascinating, and understanding the man will really help you better understand you know, what might happen next. So thanks for being with me today, Angela.
Thanks.
Look forward to talking again, okay? That's Angela Stentz. She is Senior Advisor to the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at the Brookings Institution. Also, Professor Emerita of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University. I love the fact that she actually has had dinner several times with Vladimir Putin. That's pretty cool. I can take a short pause. We'll take a look at the history between Ukraine and Russia when I return. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
As a leader who tolerates virtually no domestic opposition, Putin has a strong aversion to revolutions in neighboring countries that could encourage protests in Russia. Ukraine is potentially threatening for Putin if it inspires Russians with a pro-Western vision. Keeping the West guessing about a possible invasion of Ukraine has put Russia high on the international agenda and forced US President Joe Biden to re-engage with Putin in a video call in December. In a recent interview, Putin mourned the collapse of the Soviet Union as the demise of historical Russia. Some analysts argue such statements suggest Putin sees Ukraine as unfinished business and wants to follow the seizure of Crimea, which boosted his popularity in Russia, to bring part or all of Ukraine back under Moscow's rule.
So why is Ukraine so valuable to Russia? Let's take a look at that now. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Thank you for joining me here today. If you missed any part of the conversation, just had a wonderful conversation on who Vladimir Putin actually is. There's a lot of mystery about his past and who he is today, how he thinks, what his intentions are, I think are critical to understanding what might loom for the world's future. As you heard earlier in the broadcast, you know, the Russian president today gave a televised speech in which he claimed that the histories of Russia and Ukraine, that they are tied together. So it's only right, right? It's only right the two of them be reunited. He also said that Russia now recognizes two regions in the eastern part of Ukraine that have a lot of Russians in them. And he recognizes them to be independent countries. They're no longer part of Ukraine. And that means, of course, that by setting up these puppet governments, that's really what he's doing, right? Puppet governments in those regions, they're going to allow Russian troops in so that they can get closer to the capital of Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital. You talk about chess games. This is being masterfully played. A lot of people are decrying what he has just done. Putin is right, though, on this point. I think he's right that the histories of the two countries are, you know, intricately tied together. In fact, the seminal event of what started these two countries was the baptism of Rus back in 988, when the Grand Prince Vladimir was baptized along with a whole bunch of the population of Kyiv, and that's really the start of the Russian people as an ethnic identity, if you will. So Moscow doesn't come about actually until about the mid 12th century, and doesn't grow to become important until about the 14th. Century, but it was still, you know, it was still tied to Kyiv. So as I said, you know, Putin is right that the two countries are, you know, historically, they're linked together. The problem is that Ukraine has seen itself as independent from Russia for over a century now, since 1918. Even though it was a Soviet satellite state, the Ukrainian nation has always remained as a nation during that time, even after the Soviet Union collapsed. So let's talk about why Ukraine is so critical, why Vladimir Putin more than likely will probably roll in and take it over. And what does that mean for the rest of Europe and for the future of this nation? I'm joined today by Michael LaCivita. He's a communications director at the Catholic Near East Welfare Association. Wrote a very long essay, on their long history, if you will. It's a well-done piece, well-researched. And I thought I'd bring him on maybe to give us some insight into the history, may ultimately give us a better look at Vladimir Putin's intentions and what the future might look like. Michael, good to have you. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. Thanks for having me.
So this connection between Ukraine and Russia, it goes back a millennia, really, if you think about it. It goes back to 998, a millennium. There's even an older history from invading hordes and Scandinavians. Bring us back. I mean, give us an overview, if you could, of the two separate states and how they started to appear, and bring us up to where we are today and why this is so important to Vladimir Putin.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Drew, looking at history, or the history of Europe and the evolution of peoples, and what started, I guess you would say, the development of Europe, certainly after the Roman Empire and its dissipation, were basically the beginnings of tribal groups, ethnic groups that were largely affiliated by language and by tribe and by loyalty to the head of that tribe. And then as these tribes and cultures became more and more sophisticated, they became states or not states in the modern sense, but they became entities, usually kingdoms led by a king, you know, France and Germany, the Franks and the Germans are somewhat related historically. Their affairs certainly are, and certainly the English and the Anglo-Saxons and the Normans and who were from Northern Europe. So you have these tribes that began, and then over time you had the creation of kingdoms, and the same is what happened in Eastern Europe with the Eastern Slavic peoples, basically rallying around one chief or many chiefs who were part of a confederation. The idea of nation states and the idea of self-determination is actually a relatively new concept. It's only been around since the Romantic period of the 19th century, when they had this development of, well, I'm French and therefore I should live in a French state and led by a French president or king or what have you. And this really was a direct challenge to the great empires of Europe, the Austro-Hungarian Empire of Central Europe, the German Empire of Northern Europe, and of course the Russian Empire in the East, where you had all of these different collections of peoples that came from different ethnic groups all under one emperor, in this case in the Russian Empire under the Tsar. So you have it's interesting how you have this development of a nation state, but that's only a recent evolution in the development of our peoples. And then with the Ukrainians and the Russians, that yes, they definitely descend from the same. The point of my essay is that they descend from the same people, the Eastern Slavs, who had intermarried with other peoples, and they share ecclesiastical history, the baptism of the Grand Prince of Kiev in 988, his baptism in the Dnieper River and the acceptance of Christianity in its Byzantine form. But pretty much almost immediately, because of the context of where Eastern Slavs lived, or Kievan Rus, where it was located on the map, people began to look at different ways. Some would look farther west, some farther north, others to the south, and then those to the east. And so this is more or less a battle, or God forbid a battle, but I think what we're looking at here is different ways, perhaps. I mean, we're all basically the one God created us all. We're all, regardless of what we call ourselves, we're all, human beings created in the likeness and image of God. But our perspectives are framed or developed by context, by the context in which we live, whether it's our economics or our religion or our language or mm-hmm. our philosophy, etc. So that's what we're looking at here, even though they're basically... Their origins are the same over 1,000 years ago. Their perspectives on the world are very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could not agree with you more. Can the Ukrainian people claim a separate ethnic identity or ethnicity, if you can, from the Russian people, or not so?
Well, there are some that absolutely do. There are schools of thought, certainly in Ukraine and in the West, that suggests that there are that they're ethnically quite different, that there are groups or subgroups. In the United States, we have a group called the Carpatho-Rusyns, who have an archdiocese centered in Pittsburgh, where I'm originally from, and the Rusyns consider themselves a subgroup of what is Ukraine. And then there are groups called, I hate to call them, they're not a tribe, but the Hutsuls and other subgroups are Slavs, but they're sort of located in one area and ethnically are separate from others. But at the end of the day, we're all, as I keep saying, stressing over and over again, we're all children of the one God created in his likeness and image. All That's of these so things are really divisions that, unfortunately, it's easier to build walls than to bring them down. But they do have separate individual cultures and histories and eventually even languages.
So Michael, let's bring us to where we are today. Right now, Vladimir Putin's willing to engage NATO. it looks like... by going into Ukraine, I mean, we could see global conflict over this move. And again, he's saying, look, these are just simply exercise. I'm not going to invade. In all probability, from everybody I've spoken to, it's going to happen. Why does he want Ukraine so much? And if he gets Ukraine, then what's next? Are there ambitions to take over other nations?
Well, as I was listening a little bit to your show beforehand and of course certainly looking at what he himself has been saying and what others have been saying, none of this should be a surprise. For the Russian people that lived and grew up in the Soviet Union, Ukraine was part and parcel of their Russian identity. They were their little brothers. They somewhat looked pejoratively, and still do many, at their Ukrainian brothers, or little brothers, they would say. It was even called Little Russia at one time, sort of like White Russia, Belarusia is called to this day, a little bit farther north. What are his intentions? Who knows? But it shouldn't be a surprise that this is part of what he sees as his historic, or Russia's historic, sphere of influence. He clearly feels threatened by the West, by the expansion of NATO, by the expansion of Western influence. I think that's probably what he's most concerned about, and that is, while Ukraine is not exactly the most stable country, it's not the wealthiest country, it clearly and historically always has, that section of Eastern Europe, has always had, in terms of how it pivots, it has looked to the West more than it has to the East. Yeah. And as as the Russians, or the Great Russians, as they used to be called, asserted themselves more and more, well, the typical reaction in, among Ukrainians was to become more and more Ukrainian and look farther west.
Yeah.
So, you know, that seems to be, at least from our perspective, what he's most concerned about. And, and you know, the impact on the people and on the churches there is of great concern to us at Catholic Near East Welfare Association.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I wish I had more time. I'm just about out of it. I want to thank you for being with us today. People want to read your article, People Look East, The History Between Russia and Ukraine. What's the best way to get connected to that?
Best way is to visit our home, our website at www.cnewa.org. It's right there on the homepage.
Sounds great. I it's very well done, very comprehensive. I'm
Thank
grateful
you.
For you taking time to do that. And I said we'll probably have an opportunity to talk again in the future. But keep up your good work, okay?
Thank you very much, Drew.
Thank
Be well.
You. Yeah, thank you. You too. That's Michael LaCivita and the article People Look East. You'll find it there at that website, cnewa.org. I have to take a short pause. I'll be right back. We only have a few minutes remaining in today's show, and it is President's Day. I will share with you some fascinating presidential facts that will impress. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Now let's not overlook the fact that we're still in reach. You got a chance to make it, and you got a freedom of speech. Say what you wanna, tell them how you feel. Tell me if I'm wrong. America is still the best country, and that's without a doubt.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
America's still the best country without a doubt.
All right. Amen.
And if anybody says it ain't, you just try to put them out. They
That's
ain't going
right.
Nowhere.
I'm proud to be an American. I'm sure you are today. Happy President's Day to you. I want to give you some interesting tidbits on our president, some of the ventures that they were involved in, some things you may not have known. But before I do, I just want to put a quick reminder before you. To sign up if you have not. I'm saying to my wife, can you believe Ash Wednesday is right around the corner? I mean, literally, we're a week and just a couple days. And that's what I'm going to, you know, I'm going to hit it hard. I don't know about you. I mean, I should be hitting it hard today, right? Starting greater self-discipline, more prayer, more fasting, you know, doing all these things. I find, Lent a great time to do it because you can really couple your spirituality, you know, with whatever your discipline is going to be, whatever your sacrifice, whatever the penance is going to be. One of the things I always try to do during Lent, even the new year, whenever I set a resolution, I always try to incorporate some sort of spirituality into it so I can deepen my relationship with the Lord. I want to get you plugged into something Father Rocky is doing this year. And you might have heard it on the air. I'm sure you heard some of my colleagues talking about it. He's come out with a brand new premium edition of the Lenten Lessons. They ran last year. They were overwhelmingly successful, immensely popular. Why? Well, because they were educational. You get to learn a lot, you know, about the Mass. They're very helpful. They were very entertaining. And this year, you're going to get some behind-the-scenes insights. There's new videos that are putting out there. So if you saw them last year, you know, you're going to get some new content. And they'll show up in your inbox. You just got to go and sign up. Just simply go to relevantradio.com, okay? And you can sign up. They're free. No one's going to bother you for anything. It's kind of our gift to you. It's kind of the mission of Relevant Radio. It's what we're about, to help you with your walk with the Lord. So these are high definition, you know, videos, and you're not going to get them anywhere else. And they're packed with great facts. And I like that, little bite-sized facts, right? And I think that is, it's always the best. I was listening to a homily last night, and I came home, because I went to Mass at a different time than my wife. I went late last night. And I said, you know, when I retire, one of the things I'm going to do, if I ever retire, I hope I never do. I hope I do this till my last drawing, dying breath. But if for some reason I was to do that, I want to help the church. I went to Mass, right? And this is not an indictment on the priest or bishop or anybody else. But I was sitting there and the homily started great. It was strong. And then it just went off the rails. And I became so bored, my own mind is now wandering, you know? And I'm thinking, it'd be so great to get out there and really help the church be able to communicate in a better, more engaging, you know, type of way. And sometimes the shortest homilies, I think the Holy Father, and again, I'm cautious about saying this, but this is the Pope who said it. He thought homilies should be about 8 minutes. There are some priests who could preach for an hour and you still can't get enough of them. And there's others that could preach for 4 minutes. You're like, oh my gosh, you lost me already, right? You know what I'm talking about. But I love the fact that Father Rocky and these Lenten lessons give you those little tidbits. It's all you need. Take away something, right? Take away something. And that's what this will do. I'll give you a few tidbits on our founding, on our presidents that you might not know. You can share this today on President's Day. George Washington, our first president, of course. Well, all of our presidents, just on a spiritual note before I get derailed on that. You know, a lot of our presidents had deep faith. They really did. A lot of the presidents called us to pray. I mean, you take a look at Lincoln, you take a look at Washington. Lincoln called for days of penance and fasting and prayer, days of reparation. Religion is in our First Amendment, right? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's before freedom of speech, before freedom of the press or the right to you for you to assemble, right? It's the lead. Our nation's come a long way. But I've always loved that. So a lot of our founding fathers had profound faith. George Washington, even, I don't have time to tell you about it now. I've spoken about it in the past. Reportedly, allegedly, there's a story saying that when he was in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, you know, that the founding of our republic was, we were outnumbered and outgunned. And there's a story about a woman appearing to George Washington, you know, in Valley Forge and showing him a vision of the future. I spoke about Joseph Torelli and how the Virgin appeared to him and held out her hand and showed him a map. Washington supposedly had a very similar encounter with this unnamed woman. Many people believe it was the Mother of God. In fact, there's an author named Jan Connell who wrote a book about George Washington, and she chronicles that story in great, great detail, our first president. But, you know, on a more temporal realm, you know, Washington owned a very profitable whiskey distillery. I don't know if you like whiskey or not. Whiskey was one of Washington's most important business ventures, you know, at Mount Vernon. I would think, whiskey. That was a surprise to me when I learned about it. He had peak production in 1799, and the distillery used five stills, a boiler. They produced about 11,000 gallons of whiskey, with sales about $7,500 that year. And I don't know what that translates into, $22. A lot of coin, though, right? A lot of money right there. Gerald Ford, remember him? Gerald Ford was a fashion model in his youth. How do you like that for a little trivia? You know, guess what magazine he appeared in? He appeared, believe it or not, on the cover of Cosmopolitan. Yeah, I was shocked when I found that out. So, Warren Harding. Of all the presidents, he had the largest shoe size. That's a weird fact. It really is. I mean, a size 14. I mean, that's a big shoe. You know, unfortunately, those big feet didn't ensure that his administration would be on firm footing. It turned out that Harding's trusted advisors, if you know your history, they weren't so trustworthy, and his presidency was just riddled with scandal. And actually, he died before his term was complete, and his wife actually, they say, burned his potentially incriminating correspondence. But those stately slippers that he wore, the sporty golf shoes, they survived. And if you ever want to see them, take a visit to the Smithsonian. They're there. But a couple of our presidents actually received Nobel Peace Prizes. I always marveled, and you probably know the most recent, right? Barack Obama. I mean, junior senator becomes president, and days in office, he's getting the Nobel Peace Prize. I was always struck by that. But some of those who received them were Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Jimmy Carter was a surprise to me, too. I didn't remember that. But Carter was long retired from presidency when he won the prize. I think he got it in the early 2000s. I think it was 2002. Because he did a lot to advance human rights and work to advance peaceful solutions to a lot of international conflicts. But Obama was honored with the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009 for his work in strengthening international diplomacy and cooperation. So a lot of lot of other interesting facts. I only have about a moment left here with you, but on this President's Day, and I'll share a few more. Just I want to invite you to pray for our country, because I do believe, going back to Washington, that God has a design on our country. I really do. And maybe if I have time one day, I'd love to share with you some of these incredible stories of America's founding and God's providence and his protection from bullets, you know, that missed George Washington, to mysterious fogs that allowed escapes, to just the incredible stories like these apparitions. I believe God has a great mission for our nation. I do think we're off the rails ourselves right now with some of the wokeism and some of the immorality that we are promoting and exporting around the world. Not too late to get that back. Our founding fathers understood that it took a faithful citizenry. John Adams, you know, Ben Franklin, these founding fathers all talked about how important it was for virtue to thrive in the heart of the citizenry if we are to make it. In the 1950s, there was another vision in Fosteria, I believe it was Ohio, and in Indiana, to a nun, where the Virgin also revealed to this nun that America was given a great mission by God to lead the world in purity and in spirituality. So let's do our parts as citizens. Let's pray for our president, especially, okay, especially today on President's Day. And let's pray especially for peace in the world. I've got to take a short pause. I will be back again tomorrow. You can set your clock 21 hours from now. We'll have some more time to spend together. I hope to talk with you then. Have a great day.